Lecture 2. The Vedas and Upanishads, the Beginning.
Hello. Welcome back. We're going to start our survey of the Eastern intellectual tradition in India with two anonymous collections of writings, the Vedas and the Upanishads, and our first great thinker, Udalika, who may have been one of the first philosophers in the history of the world. He lived about 800 BC and is one of the many sages who appear in the Upanishads. Unfortunately, we don't know much at all about the authors of those texts. Sometimes, for our earliest great minds, we know more about their thoughts than we know about their lives. But I can tell you something about the historical background of those writers, whoever they were. You probably remember that many of the oldest civilizations started on river valleys. Around 3500 BC or so, in Sumeria, civilization started in the Mesopotamia. Remember, that's the region between the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers. And then a few centuries later, Egyptian civilization began on the Nile River. And about 1,000 years after Mesopotamia, so we're talking, say, 2500 BC, another civilization began on the Indus River in what's today Pakistan. For this course, for most of it, I'm just going to talk about India, but India at the time is going to be the whole subcontinent, so it will include what's today Pakistan and India and Bangladesh. The oldest civilization in this part of the world, in India, is called the Indus River Valley Civilization. It's sometimes called Harappan, after one of its major cities that archaeologists have discovered. The people of Harappa, or the Indus River Valley, flourished for about 1,000 years, from 2500 to 1500 BC. And as far as we can tell from the archaeological remains, they were a rather impressive people. They controlled a vast area, larger than Western Europe, with hundreds of cities, with extensive trade, and with indoor plumbing. That's always kind of an impressive thing to us today. We don't know as much about them as we would like, though, because their writing system has never been deciphered. There isn't very much of it, so it's hard to work with. It may never be deciphered. It is clear, though, that about the time the Harappans began to decline, another people came into India from the west, through Afghanistan. And these are called the Aryans, or as scholars prefer to call them, the Indo-Aryans. Okay, quick note of caution before we move on. These Aryans had nothing to do with Hitler. As with so much else, the Nazis took a traditional term and then twisted its meaning so that it's something different than what it traditionally meant. The same thing happens with the swastika, which is an old, traditional, actually an ancient symbol in Hinduism that represents the god Vishnu or Brahma, or sometimes it's a symbol of good luck. So if you go to India today, you may see swastikas there, but they have nothing to do with anti-Semitism. The ancient Indian Aryans, and the name means the noble people, were nomadic cattle herders who, over the course of several centuries, migrated from the northwest into the Indus River Valley, down the river. They gradually settled down, took up agriculture, and intermingled with the descendants of the Harappans. We know a lot more about the Aryans because of their literature, which somewhat remarkably remained unwritten for almost a millennium. It was just passed down orally by Brahmin priests who specialized in memorizing, and were very good at precisely memorizing. And we're going to start by talking about the Vedas. Now, these are collections of hymns and some other ritual texts that began as oral literature, the kind that I told you about, carefully memorized and preserved by the Brahmins, the priests. The oldest, largest, and most important of the four Vedas is called the Rig Veda, and it includes about 1,028 hymns to various gods. And through them, we can learn something about the Aryans' lifestyle and their clothing, their food, their social structure, and of course their religion, because all of those things are mentioned in the Vedas. The Aryans worshipped a multitude of gods, mostly associated with natural phenomena such as the sun, the wind, air, storms. One god, Indra, gets a lot of attention because he's the sky god who wields the thunderbolt and defeated the dragon-like Rhitra, who had been holding back the waters. That is the rain, right? So that sort of makes sense, that the lightning comes and then the rains come. And let me just read to you a little bit from this. He who slew the dragon, freed the seven rivers from the cave of Vala, he, O men, is Indra. Even the heaven and the earth bow down before him. Before his very breath, the mountains tremble. Known as the Soma drinker, and Soma is an ancient hallucinogenic of some sort, armed with thunder, who wields the bolt, he, O ye men, is Indra. There's much that's strange here, but there are also some familiar elements. The Vedic gods seem to be organized into a large family. And they are, they have human-like characteristics. They get angry, they're jealous, they have favorites, they scrap amongst themselves, and they can be influenced by ritual and by sacrifice. Okay, that sounds a little like the gods of Mesopotamia, but even more like the gods of ancient Greece and Rome, or even Scandinavia. I mean, Indra sounds a little bit like Zeus or Thor. There's a good reason for this. The Aryans were an Indo-European people, and their language and religion were related to those of other Indo-Europeans. Okay, Indo-European is a language family, and the earliest speakers lived in around the Ukraine or southern Russia, and then they spread into Europe and then down into India as well. Just as Romance languages, such as French, Italian, Spanish, are all descended from Latin, right, from Roman ways of speaking, most of the modern European languages, along with those of Persia and North India, are derived from Indo-European. So Sanskrit, the sacred language of the Vedas, is somewhat related, distantly related to Greek, Russian, even English. Okay, as an example, the Aryans worshiped the god Agni, the god of fire, and his name is cognate, right? It's a linguistic similar name with our word igneous, if you remember geology, or the word ignite. Even the word Veda is related to our own word video. It's something that can be seen, and then it comes to denote wisdom or knowledge, as in, oh, I see. And in the same way, Vedas mean wisdom. It appears that most of the Vedic hymns were written to accompany rituals and sacrifices. And much of their content is just what you'd expect in a hymn book. There is extravagant praise for the various gods and goddesses, along with some pleas for future blessings. But because religion often deals with the great questions of life, there are also hymns that addressed creation, or the order of the universe, or the origins of social conventions. For instance, the god Varuna was thought to know everything and to enforce justice and to preserve the world's smooth functioning. Okay, he sees everything so he can reward it or punish it. There's also a hymn to Purusha, a primordial deity who is sacrificed by the gods. Purusha's mind became the moon, his eye the sun, the sky came from his head, and the earth came from his feet. And perhaps most intriguingly, in the same hymn, we see the first indications of a caste system that was introduced by the Indo-Europeans, with its four major divisions. Up at the top are Brahmins, or priests, and they come from Purusha's mouth. Then the Kshatriyas, or the warrior rulers, come from his arms, because it wields weapons. And then the Vaishyas, or the commoners, and those are going to be landowners, merchants, from his thighs. And then the Shudras, and those are the laborers, the servants, from his feet. This last, lowest caste was descended from people who had inhabited the land before the Aryans arrived and were excluded from Vedic religion. Outcasts, who you may have heard of, are people who don't even fit into there. Like what do you do with a child who's born from a Brahmin mother and a Shudra father? What caste does he go into? Actually, no caste. He's just out of it, the whole system. And their lives were truly miserable. It's not a coincidence that in this hymn, the Brahmins are mentioned first, and they're associated with Purusha's mouth. The priests memorized the Vedas, and then they performed the sacrifices that accompanied them, and they had an interest in upholding their social status. In fact, the Vedic religion is oftentimes called Brahmanism, to distinguish it from the later related but distinct set of religious beliefs and practices that we call Hinduism. And remember, as I said, even though the Vedas were first composed sometimes before 1500 and 1000 BC, they weren't written down until the 4th to the 6th century AD. For like 1,000 years, they're preserved orally. Hindus today refer to the most sacred revelations, which are going to include the Vedas, as Shruti, that which is heard, as opposed to Smriti, that which is remembered. And that's a secondary class of scriptures that will include the epics that we'll be talking about in Lecture 5, the Mahabharata and the Bhagavad Gita. So there's something magical about the revealed words themselves as they were recited and spoken aloud. But even hymns thought to embody eternal truths could still be perplexing in many ways. There's a multiplicity of gods and creation stories in the Vedas. And oftentimes, when you're talking about a god, he's the greatest god of them all. And then, as I said, there's a number of creation stories. They don't exactly match up. They're not consistent. And from this comes perhaps a degree of skepticism. Here's a famous quote from the Song of Creation. "Who verily knows, and who can here declare it, whence it was born, and whence comes this creation? The gods are later than this world's production. Who knows, then, whence it first came into being?" And then the answer is going to be, "He, the first origin of this creation, whether he formed it all or did not form it, whose eye controls this world in the highest heaven, he verily knows, or perhaps he knows not." How extraordinary that is, that maybe even the God who oversees creation, maybe he doesn't even really know how it all works. Ritual is going to maintain the order of the cosmos. There are sacred ceremonies that keep things working smoothly. And that leads to an idea of religion as deal-making, right? You perform sacrifices and ritual in return for protection and prosperity from the gods. But it doesn't always work out that way. And when things went poorly, kings tended to blame the Brahmins, the priest, who in turn argued that not every officiator was properly trained. Of course, the gods would ignore sloppy offerings. Note that their solution requires more expertise, more royal support. They're not going to undercut their privileged position in society. So the Brahmins developed a set of ritual texts called the Brahmanas, which specified, sometimes in excruciating detail, exactly how rituals were to be performed. They said the precise amount and quality of materials to be used. They gave the precise pronunciation of sacred words. These texts are added to the Vedas with the idea that if sacrifices were performed exactly, then the gods would be compelled to respond. But these perfected rituals didn't always work either. And there were still others who thought that the whole business of ritual had gone too far. Was religion really a matter of ever more specialized and detailed rule books? What was the real meaning of rituals and sacrifices? Some Indians began to devote their lives to religious questions, living as ascetic hermits, rejecting ordinary material concerns, giving up family life, and shifting their attention from prosperity in this life to the nature of ultimate reality. And they compiled their speculations into texts called the Upanishads. Now, there's external fire that's part of all of these Vedic rituals and sacrifices, and now that's getting shifted to an internal fire. There's a power that comes from asceticism, from self-denial for religious reasons, as in fasting or celibacy or meditation, which is in some ways a kind of fasting of the mind. And this might be a familiar process to you. Catholics have Lent, where they give up something in return for or to help focus their attention on spiritual matters. Muslims don't eat during daylight hours for the whole month of Ramadan. So we see these sort of practices elsewhere. Other people argued, this is still in India now, that the most important thing wasn't the ritual itself, but it was the spiritual reality that was behind the ritual. So to go through a ritual step by step in one's mind, mentally, might be just as efficacious as actually performing the actions and words, you know, out loud. These teachings eventually became attached to the Vedas as part of the vast oral literature of India. And it's in these last stages of this tradition, the Upanishads, that we start to see serious philosophizing, as thinkers struggled with the basic questions of death and existence and knowledge, and as that element of skepticism starts to come in. The word Upanishad means to sit close to, and the idea is that you're sitting close to a teacher, a guru, learning or leaning in to hear some secret teaching. The Upanishads, like the Vedas, are considered Shruti. Remember, that's revealed oral texts. And in this case, they're revealed by sages who have gained some sort of insight into the nature of self and cosmos and who are willing to share that. There are 13 major Upanishads, some 108 total, and they date from about 900 to 500 BC. Most of them take the form of dialogues or debates, and they're frequently long and complicated and sometimes rather opaque. Because they were composed over the period of several centuries by numerous anonymous thinkers, they don't offer a comprehensive, consistent system of thought. But they do develop some basic principles, and among the most important are samsara, karma, dharma, and moksha. Okay, we'll talk about each of those. Samsara is reincarnation. The idea is that after we die, we'll be reborn again in another body. And perhaps a human, perhaps an animal even, but in a regular cycle of birth and death, rebirth, re-death, I guess. The concept is foreign to many in the West, but imagine what might be attractive about reincarnation, or what it might explain. Okay. First thing that might come to mind is you get lots of chances. I mean, in this life, if you don't get things quite right, you'll have another chance later on. And perhaps this is one reason that in India, oftentimes, religious controversy seems less intense than sometimes elsewhere, in Europe or in the Middle East. If you're wrong, you'll have a chance to fix it sometime. Think about déjà vu. Now, I know that psychologists give scientific explanations of how this happens, where you feel like you've been someplace that you know you've never been before, or done something that you know you've never done. I assume, though, that people have been feeling this as long as people have had modern human brains. And reincarnation gives you an explanation. Or think about people who have some sort of precocious genius, maybe Mozart, say, who seems to almost be born with gifts beyond other people. And reincarnation says it's because he developed them earlier on. Or there might be different experiences between rich and poor. And you wonder what that might be like. And in reincarnation, you'll have a chance to try them all. Actually, even gender is not eternal. That, I don't know, have you ever wondered what it was like to be on the other side of the gender divide? Every male in this life will someday be female and vice versa as well. So another example, or another possibility of something is immediate friendships. Have you ever hit it off just right away with somebody as you first met, or maybe dislike somebody right away? And reincarnation says, perhaps you had some connection earlier on, and then perhaps some romantic possibilities. I once published a book, and in the dedication that I made to my wife, I used the Chinese phrase, yuan sheng sheng, sure, sure, wei fu fu, that means, lives and worlds to come, may we always be reborn as husband and wife. I don't believe in reincarnation myself, but I still think that's about the sweetest thing that you could ever say to somebody. If I had to do it over again, I would still choose you again and again. But perhaps the most important thing that reincarnation gives is some sense of justice, that there are disparities. Some people are richer or are healthier or are smarter. And why is that? And reincarnation says it has to do with what happened in the past. The world is a just sort of place. Okay, next term is karma, which means action. But the idea is that all actions have consequences, good or bad. And the law of karma says that that's what will determine your next life. It's sort of a cosmic justice. Okay, there's no judge, there's no forgiveness, there's only this natural, eternal law. So reincarnation doesn't happen randomly. If you're good, you'll be reborn in a better situation. If you're bad, you may be reborn in a worse situation as a person. Or if you're really bad, you may not even be a human. You may be reborn as a dog or as a rat or as a cockroach even. And so animals are in this process. Even the gods are in this process of being reborn. You may have played the game Chutes and Ladders when you were growing up. That's a game that Americans get from England, where it's called Snakes and Ladders, and the Britons got it from India when India was a colony then, and it had to do with reincarnation, that you could go up in your next life, or you could slide down on the back of a snake if you were deserved something lower, perhaps. The third term is dharma, which means right behavior, duty, morality, but in particular, caste duty. I guess it could also mean justice or truth or reality. And this is the ordinary norm for whatever situation in life you're in. Now, some people criticize this and say, Dharma sounds like a tool to keep the lower classes in their place. And perhaps, I mean, you know, if you're born a servant, your job is to just be the best servant you can be and see how it goes until the next life. But also, there's an element of compassion that comes, because when you see someone who is unfortunate, you may think, that could have been me once, or that might be someone that I once loved in another past life. So I'm not sure that religions are good or bad in themselves. They all have the potential for kindness and compassion, as well as for judgment and less pleasant sorts of interactions. The fourth term is moksha, and this is the extraordinary goal. Rather than just trying to get a good next life, you want to get out of this cycle of existence entirely. This is moksha's release or liberation. The Indians realize that most people's lives are not good. Most of them are miserable, and living life over and over gets sort of pointless. It's sort of like, you may recall the Bill Murray movie, Groundhog Day, right? The same day, lived over and over and over. After a while, he just wants to escape. Even the same life, 50, 60, 70 years, over and over and over, it doesn't mean much. And if you're looking for permanence, for peace, for freedom from suffering, you want to escape that cycle of existence entirely through moksha. How do you do that? And one of the key ideas is liberation through knowledge. So I'm going to give you three more important terms. Two are Indian, one is Western. Brahman. This is the one underlying substance, the unchanging absolute being, the ultimate external reality that creates and sustains everything that we see around us. And it's beyond all description. Okay. The next term is Atman, the unchanging eternal self, its ultimate introspective reality that can only be perceived by direct experience, maybe through meditation. It's the answer to the question, what am I at the deepest level of my existence? Now, the great breakthrough in the Upanishads is the equation Atman equals Brahman, which to the ancient Indians was every bit as exciting as E equals MC squared. Okay, Atman equals Brahman. That means the innermost essence of what makes up you is identical to what makes up everything else. So, take for example this podium and myself. What's the difference between us? Sometimes my students would say, you're about as interesting as that. But ultimately, I'm made up of molecules. Those are made up of atoms. Those are made up of subatomic particles, protons and neutrons. And so is this podium. So there's some way in which I'm connected to the outside world. But it's not like modern science in that it's like a machine, sort of. It's just materialism. In India, this connection, Atman and Brahman, is a spiritual sort of great consciousness. Okay, I told you three terms. One more, monism. This is the term from Western philosophy. Monism is like mono, right? It's one thing. The world isn't two things or many things. It's just one thing. So it's an illusion that everyone and everything are separate. And with this realization, we can be freed from ego, from reincarnation, and from the suffering that we experience when we're reabsorbed into Brahman, into the great world soul. And the Indians say it's like a drop of water returning to the ocean. So you can realize that you aren't separate, you're actually the same. Salvation comes from moral purity, from introspection, from meditation, from this mystic knowledge of the self, which gives us access to Brahman. And that's moksha. But you're not saved as an individual. You sort of lose your individuality as you come to realize that you're part of this whole. And now we're to our first philosopher, Udalaka. There are over 100 sages that appear in the Upanishads, actually including some sagely women, too. But to give you a better sense of how these texts work, I'll talk for a few minutes about one of the earliest and most famous of these seers, these people who have insight, Udalaka. He lives about 800 BC. In the Chandogya Upanishad, the story is told of Udalaka and his son Shvetaketu. Shvetaketu went away to study the Vedas with a teacher when he was 12 years old. And he studies for 12 years, and then he comes back to his family, very proud of what he's learned, a little bit arrogant. And his father Udalaka asks if he's gotten the wisdom that allowed him to hear the unheard, to perceive what's unperceivable, to know the unknown. Right. It's sort of like, you know, if you think you're so smart, tell me about this. Okay. Shvetaketu has no idea what his father's talking about. And at that point, Udalaka employs a series of metaphors and analogies to enlighten his son. Udalaka tells him that by knowing one lump of clay, he can know about all clay things. And one gold nugget can tell him about all objects that are made from gold. Right? The idea is that a single substance, like gold, can take many different sorts of forms. So you concentrate on that single substance. He talks about Brahman, this pure being, absolute being. And then he tells Shvetaketu, you are that. The boy doesn't quite understand. So Udalaka compares it to honey, which is made by bees from many flowers, but in the end is simply one indivisible substance, right? You can't tell exactly which flower produced what bit of honey that you're using. And then he continues, and let me read this to you. These rivers, my son, run, the eastern toward the east, the western toward the west. They go from sea to sea, they become indeed sea. And as those rivers, when they're in the sea, do not know, I'm of this or that river, in the same manner, my son, all these creatures, when they have come back from being, know not that they have come back from being. This is the Brahman. Whatever those creatures are here, whether a lion or a wolf, a boar, a worm, a midge, a gnat, or a mosquito, they become again and again. That which is that subtle essence, in it all that exists has itself. Its being, it is the self, and you, Shvetaketu, are that. Right, you are this Brahman that's everything. And then Udalaka goes on to give perhaps the most famous demonstration of all. He asks his son to go and get a banyan fruit and then to cut it open. What do you see inside? He asks. And the son says, well, I see some small seeds here. Break open a seed and tell me what's there. And he cuts it open and he says, nothing, really. And Udalaka explains that there's actually an infinitely small, invisible substance there that's the essence of the banyan tree, that's throughout the tree. And then he says, again, you, Shvetaketu, are that. Of course, his point is that Brahman and Atman are one and the same. And after a few more examples, the Upanishad records that Shvetaketu finally understood this teaching. I mean, I guess this is a great moment in father-son bonding. Though from this lesson that he's trying to teach him, aren't they really the same? And aren't they the same with the rest of the cosmos after all? Okay, let me give you some comparisons with Western philosophy. Like the Greek pre-Socratic philosophers, the search for what's lasting and unchanging is what matters. So you may remember Thales, who said that everything is water underneath the surface. And Heraclitus said, no, it's fire. Everything is sort of a form of fire. There are also differences with Greek philosophy. In Greek thought, individualism and competition are pretty important. Not so much in India. In India, they give much more attention to suffering. There's not very much social experimentation with the caste system, and they concentrate on ritual rather than politics, which was a major concern in the age of city-states in ancient Greece. How about some comparisons with the Hebrews? Okay, it's like they're similar in that the Hebrews cared about creation and the relationship of the human and divine, and they do in India as well. But in India, history isn't as central. It's not that you can know God by seeing how he's acted in history. The Indian religion is a little more flexible. Obviously, Indian religion, Brahmanism, is polytheist. Lots of different gods and goddesses. But it might also be monotheist from a certain perspective. There's just one substance, one Brahman. The gods are all one. They just go by different names or they have different forms. You may have heard of avatars, as a god will take a different form and be manifest on earth. So that Krishna is an avatar of Vishnu. Or India may also be atheist. I mean, it may be that it's just all an illusion in the end. So there's also a different view of nature from India and the ancient Hebrews. No sharp divide between creator and created. You know, animals and humans and gods are sort of all on the same spectrum. Just as the concept of a single creator God who intervenes in history and will judge all men and women underlies the religions of Judaism and Christianity and Islam, So also the metaphysical package of samsara, right, reincarnation, karma, which is cosmic justice, dharma, this duty, and moksha, liberation, are at the heart of the three great Asian religions, Hinduism, Jainism, and Buddhism. But there are some subtle differences in how these ideas are understood in those religions. And we'll talk about that in the next two lectures on Jainism and Buddhism. See you then.